Star Court Study Hall contains spoilers for seasons 1 through 4 of Stranger Things and for Stranger Things, The First Shadow. This episode may also contain graphic content and language not suitable for all listeners.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the hosts, unless otherwise stated, and all content and characters are property of Netflix and the Duffer Brothers.
I'm Amanda.
I'm Marina.
And this is Star Court Study Hall.
Everybody, we're here. Amanda's back. You didn't realize she was gone, No. But she's here and she's back.
I am back. I'm back on land and I'm grateful.
She's a little tan.
Yeah. Wait, you want to see my watch tan?
Wow, it's beautiful.
Right? So, you know, I was really, really pale to begin with, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah. But no, I could see it in your face a little bit. So Amanda's a little bit tan.
Yay.
Tanner than usual. So today what we're going to do on Star Court Study Hall is another Just the Facts episode, of which there are plenty this season so far, largely because the season is just rife with the historical, Hence why we've had like 12 of these. Today we are going to go to Penhurst, not the one where Victor is being held, the real actual one. And I personally had no idea that there was a real Penhurst. I don't remember when we discovered it, but I think I came upon an article. Mm-hmm. And then I sent it to Amanda and I was like, hey, this is a thing. And this is just really nothing at all to sneeze at. So some of my sources today include the Britannica's, as always, the University of Pennsylvania, several UK historical sites, two books, all good things. And we're going to get right into it with some disclaimers.
Okay.
So this is less of a disclaimer and more of just an FYI. The Stranger Things wiki states that it was indeed the actual Penhurst that inspired the facility in the show. And I don't know how whoever wrote the wiki corroborated this fact, but the more I read about this place, the more I hoped that this was not actually true.
Oh, God.
Yes. The history of psychiatric hospitals and facilities like them, it's a dark, disturbing, and it often showcases the worst of humanity. Humanity at its worst, I guess. Please know that we will be discussing mental illness as it was defined throughout Western history, which is not necessarily how it is defined today. The abuses suffered by patients and the sordid conditions of these facilities. This is and was a human rights issue, and this is not going to be pleasant. But the representation and treatment of those with mental illness and intellectual disabilities is important, and it's relevant to our season 4 content. Mm-hmm. On this note, I'd also like to say that the actions that we take and the decisions that we make are limited by our lack of knowledge. The people of these time periods did not know what they did not know. And that's just the fact of it. And this is never an excuse, but it does provide context. Mm-hmm. There are several words used historically that we no longer use. In fact, some of them are slurs and they are considered hate speech. Others are considered insensitive. They're mostly obsolete at this point. That being said, there are some proper nouns and names of locations and laws that do use these words. We don't take it lightly referencing the words and their historical context, but I do think it's important, and I will give a warning before I state the word. We are going to spend most of our time discussing the Western history of this topic. So that's not to say that there isn't a history from other parts of the world surrounding mental illness and the facilities and that type of stuff. But we're discussing Western history. And please listen with caution. If anything that I just said is uncomfortable for you, it's okay if this episode is not what you need today or tomorrow or ever, really. So let's get into it. We'll try to, you know, we'll do our best. We'll bring some lightness to it. But this is serious stuff. So I just want everybody to kind of know that before we go into it. And before we talk about Penhurst specifically, I'd like to discuss the history of psychiatric facilities in general. Now, they went by a variety of names before they became known more recently as psychiatric hospitals, such as the lunatic asylum, the insane asylum, or if you go very far back, the madhouse or the pauper asylum. Now, a lot of us know the word asylum, to mean a place of refuge or protection. And nowadays, it's associated more with people who are fleeing from one country to another for one reason or the next. Political upheaval, genocide, other horrible, inhumane things. But regardless, people are seeking sanctuary. And prior to the 1800s, the term mental health really was not coined or used at all. The word mad was used to describe people, among other words, such as lunatic, imbecile, distracted, insane, idiot, and cretin. Okay. Which one has you distracted. Confused? Yeah. Mm-hmm. These words were used to refer to not just people who genuinely suffered with mental illness, but also people who had intellectual disabilities, neurological disorders, you name it, honestly. And we are going to see a list of reasons why people were admitted into these asylums.
Yeah, I'm imagining this is going to have a lot of crossover with when we talked about Phineas Gage and lobotomies.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So these private madhouses, as they were known, were pretty unique to Great Britain. And before the inception of public facilities in the 1800s, the treatment of individuals who displayed certain symptoms or behaviors was seen largely as a domestic issue. So they were either treated in the home by family members or by visiting doctors or nurses, or people were sent to these private facilities paid for by their families. And some of these facilities were also like religiously funded to a degree, and their intake of patients was considered charitable. And as you would expect, the poor often ended up imprisoned or homeless if they displayed any types of behavior that wasn't considered normal. Hmm. And the goal of these facilities prior to the 1800s was less focused on cure and more focused on custody. So keep these people out of society's hair. Thanks.
Hmm. Okay.
There were over 150 private madhouses in England between 1640 and 1815. That's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. Over 200 years almost.
Yeah. Wow. And when, like, these were literally, like, these could be a literal home that was turned into a quote unquote madhouse.
Okay.
Yes. The first and oldest institution that serviced the so-called insane opened in 1247 in London, and it was called the Priory of the New Order of Our Lady Bethlehem. And by the 1400s, those deemed insane by society made up the majority of this place's patients. And when I say majority, I mean 30, because that's all it could hold.
Wow.
Yeah. This place was tiny. And to boot, this was basically Great Britain's only facility of this kind for almost 400 years, because it wasn't until like 1640 to 18, that time period that we just talked about, that these other madhouses started to exist. So for the better part of 400 years, this Priory of the New Order of Our Lady Bethlehem was the only actual facility to exist for people.
That's quite a mouthful of a name.
It is. It is. It goes by other names, which we will talk about, but Yeah, shortened it. Nowadays, I don't remember what it's called today, but they usually just refer to it as Bethlehem.
Okay.
So when Bethlehem was finally expanded in 1630, it started to admit patients for payment. Hmm. And there was quite the disparity between those who were paying to be there versus those who were not. And this facility is often referred to as Bedlam. And yes, it is from this hospital that the word Bedlam came to even be.
Wow.
Yes. Over time, the word Bethlehem morphed into the word Bedlam. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the word, Bedlam refers to any situation where pandemonium prevails. And again, by the 1400s, Bethlehem housed mostly mentally ill patients, but this included people who had intellectual disabilities, falling sickness, aka epilepsy, dementia, and dozens of other ailments, some entirely unrelated to actual emotional wellness.
Oh.
And there we go. There's the name. This facility still operates today. It goes by Bethlehem Royal Hospital. 1247, this place was opened.
Wow.
And it still functions today.
Same building?
It's expanded quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. 1247. I mean, being American, we can't even like fathom something that old.
2024 minus 1247. 777 years.
That's wild.
This hospital has functioned. Once private madhouses began to pop up around 1615, a lot of them were within 2 miles of Bethlehem. And at the time, these private facilities relied heavily on two strategies, religion and restraint. So restraints were commonplace because, as I mentioned, the goal was custody, not cure. Chains, straitjackets, harnesses that went around the neck, chest, arms, or legs, and devices called restraint or coercion chairs were used to prevent patients from acting out against themselves or others. And as you can imagine, these practices were extremely dehumanizing and demoralizing for the patients, and many of the attendants also felt demoralized having to actually use these things on people.
Wow.
In 1829, a patient by the name of William Scrivenger at a facility in Lincoln, England, then known as the Lincoln Lunatic Asylum, tragically died by strangulation due to these restraints. And it was his death that led to the eventual adoption of a non-restraint system.
Wow. And I know, like, even today, there's a lot of controversy around restraints of children in facilities mm-hmm. like this, children with autism. And yeah, like, I know that that's a big thing, even still today.
One of the things that I learned doing this episode was that these things that feel long ago weren't really long ago.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about asylum reform in England. As we know, facilities like Bethlehem and the dozens of other madhouses were either private or church-funded and therefore not regulated. For much of the 18th century, there was no state regulation or responsibility for the daily happenings or day-to-day management of private asylums. In 1774, an act called the Madhouse Act of 1774 was passed in England. And this act introduced a licensing system. So facilities had to meet certain requirements to function, and they had to undergo yearly inspection. So it's okay. All right. Okay. All right. Okay. It was put into place for two reasons. One, families were paying to have their perfectly sane relatives kept in these so-called madhouses. Oh, so no. there was no checks and balances of who's in these places.
Wow.
And also, the conditions of the madhouses themselves were abhorrent. It was terrible conditions that these people were being forced to live in, paid for by their families.
Wow.
By the end of the 1700s, there were just under 50 of these licensed private asylums in England. Now, if we compare that to the number of madhouses, 150, that theoretically means that there were still 100 unlicensed facilities.
Right.
The first large public asylums were built in the early 1800s, mostly in Europe, and the inception of these public facilities had a lot to do with shifting viewpoints. As the medical community's understanding of mental illness broadened, there was a need for a more humane approach to mental health care, and there was an increased emphasis on cure over custody. So how can we treat these people versus just contain them? Now, please understand that what was considered humane in the early 1800s is still by no stretch considered humane today.
Okay.
There were several individuals who were at the helm of this reform. So Harriet Martineau, she was known as the first female social scientist. And in 1834, she wrote an article called The Hanwell Lunatic Asylum, which we will discuss, which was published in Tate's Edinburgh Magazine, an English publication. And in the article, she outwardly questioned the conditions of this facility and the treatment of those within it. Felipe Pinel, who sounds a lot like Nicholas Flamel to me.
Yeah.
Every time I read his name, I was like, oh, Nicholas Flamel. No, it's Felipe Pinel. He was a French psychiatrist who was one of the first to propose. Are you ready for it?
I don't know. This is groundbreaking.
He was one of the first to propose that mental illness was not the result of demonic possession, but instead, quote, the result of excessive exposure to social and psychological stresses and in some measure of heredity and physiological damage.
All right. Well, this guy is obviously a witch.
Clearly. Yes. Like, burn him at the stake. Let's get going.
Right.
Just a side note, the ways in which mentally ill patients were treated was due in part to a complete lack of understanding of these disorders. I mean, Bethlehem opened in 1247, okay? And 600 years later, Felipe was like, huh, maybe these people are not possessed by demons.
Right. 600.
600 years.
That's a lot of years.
A lot of years for people to be operating under false pretenses.
And when you consider, like, the fact that the people in these facilities thought that they were up against demons. Just like, yeah. The treatment of these people really comes into question.
That's such a good point, too, because I hadn't even considered, like, so everyone around you believes that you're possessed by a demon, right? And you yourself, who's actually suffering, knows no better either.
Right.
So you have no understanding of your disease either.
Yeah.
Nobody knew.
Yeah.
Samuel Tuke and his grandson, William Tuke, founded and operated The Retreat. Again, this place is still open, which is a nonprofit hospital in York, England, devoted to the moral treatment of those with mental illness. Okay. It opened in 1796. Let me define the moral treatment. So the moral treatment was a therapeutic approach that emphasized character and spiritual development and called for kindness on the part of all who came in contact with the patient.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. And finally, Dr. William Charles Ellis, who was, this to me did not feel like a coincidence because there were a lot of psychiatric minds with the last name Ellis. And in the scene of the massacre at Hawkins Lab, it's Dr. Ellis who was killed.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dr. William Charles Ellis, who was the first superintendent at Hanwell Asylum, practiced non-restraint and moral therapy, as did his successor, John Connolly. So, okay, we're kind of like moving in the right direction here as there is an increase in the understanding of what these people are actually dealing with.
Yeah.
From these shifts in attitudes came a whole lot of legislation. So firstly, the recognition of mental illness as something curable, or at the very least treatable, was becoming more commonplace. Also, state-run asylums became somewhat mandatory, as prisons or workhouses were no longer acceptable alternatives. So you couldn't just put these people in prison.
Okay.
And finally, there was a newly placed emphasis on using the latest scientific and medical knowledge of mental illness in the development of the facilities.
That seems really important.
It does. Let's use our knowledge to inform our decision making. Mm-hmm. In 1845, the County Asylum / Lunatic Act was passed in England, which meant that counties were now legally obligated to provide asylum for people with mental deficiencies. Between 1845 and 1890, over the course of 45 years, over 60 state or public asylums were built. By 1950, there were over 100 of these facilities in England and Wales, containing over 150,000 patients.
That's a lot of patients.
I literally hear my heartbeat in my head reading that.
And I mean, 150,000 sounds like a lot today, and the world population was not 7 billion.
Uh-huh. Yes. So let's find out why.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, I think this does feel like we're moving in the right direction. Progress is slow and painful, and it's definitely not linear. But there were a slew of issues with the state model, too. And I've already said there was very loose criteria for admission. I'm going to read you some of these reasons for admission, okay?
Wow.
Yes, here we go. I'm not going to read them all because there are a lot. From 1864 to 1889. This is not that long ago, everyone. Mm-hmm. I think we really need to put that into context. Kicked in the head by a horse. Imaginary female trouble.
Same.
Who could know what that was? Jealousy and religion.
Okay.
Masturbation for 30 years.
Specifically.
Yeah, I don't know if that means you've been engaging in masturbation for 30 years or if you've just been straight up masturbating for 30 years.
Also, masturbation appears on here like several times in different variations. So there's like
it does.
The 30 years one. There's tobacco and masturbation.
Yeah.
Wow. Masturbation and syphilis, too. My uh-huh. goodness.
Novel reading.
Wow.
Well, you know, just check me in. Parents were cousins.
That seems like a good reason to need therapy, to be fair.
Asthma.
Yeah.
Okay. Bad company.
Like the band?
Yeah. You're a big fan. Bad whiskey. Desertion by husband? I mean, mm-hmm. That's pretty shitty.
That feels legit.
Fighting fire.
Yeah.
The war.
The war.
Which, like, yes.
Okay.
Women trouble?
Sure.
Snuff eating for 2 years.
Specifically? Gotta yes. stop that.
Hard study.
Right. Studied too hard.
One of my favorites, seduction and disappointment as one.
Seduction and disappointment.
Yes. Fell from horse in war.
Specifically.
So as you can see, okay, very loose criteria here.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to say one more that I see here.
Please.
Deranged masturbation. What does it mean?
Who's to say? Okay. But yes, this is a fun list. I will give it credit where credit is due. Again, this is not that long ago.
Yeah.
This is, I'm gonna do the math for all of us. This was 1864 to 1889 that these were the criteria for admission. Okay. So that's 160 years ago.
That is not that long.
That is not that long. It's really just not.
No.
Now, we laugh about some of these. Yes, they're funny. But the greater point here is that there was just a lot of generalization. Mm-hmm. What classified a mental illness versus an intellectual disability versus a neurological disorder, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There were very few lines drawn. And this will become particularly relevant when we eventually talk about Pennhurst. Another blatant issue was that the majority of these patients were female. As you can imagine, mm-hmm. you know, pretty long-standing trope for the reason that it is because men, husbands, yeah. would lock their wives away because they were hysterical
yes.
and all that good stuff. And as I said, another big issue was that there was a sort of class system within the asylums themselves. There were glaring differences between the treatments of patients who were paying to be there versus not. One of the first state-run institutions, which I've already mentioned, was the Middlesex County Lunatic Asylum at Hanwell in London. And this facility opened in 1832, and as I said, Dr. William Charles Ellis was the first superintendent of this facility, along with his wife, Mildred Ellis. Good for Mildred.
Yeah, the Ellises.
Yeah. His primary belief was that patients should be treated as normal people, and they should have occupations. So I kind of struggle with this idea of treating as normal. I do think there's a little bit of an issue if treating as normal translates to ignoring the reality of someone's condition. We can treat people humanely and compassionately and still address their problems, I think.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know what was meant by this.
Right. That's why, like, accommodations exist in the real world.
Precisely. In the real world.
You know, like, this wasn't the real world. But, yeah. you know, like, yeah, that's
today.
That's why, yeah, like, today, that's why accommodations exist. Like, when you go to the crosswalk and there's those little bumps before you get to the road.
It's yes.
so that vision impaired people know that there is a street coming.
Exactly. So, it's not treating as normal.
Right.
It's just normalizing.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a really good distinction. So this facility ran as a sort of self-sufficient community with 320 of the 560 patients employed on the grounds during Ellis's time as superintendent.
That's kind of cool.
And many, it is. Labor laws.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, in theory.
We're gonna get into that.
In theory, it's kind of cool.
Yes, in theory, but in practice. That's a really, like, common problem with all of these facilities yeah. is that in the theory versus the practice. Mm-hmm. Many of the state institutions function this way as these, like, self-running facilities. This was one of the first facilities to implement a non-restraint policy, but the attendants and the staff were at a loss for what to do in replacement of this method, especially for the patients who at times struggled with controlling their behaviors. And the non-restraint method resulted in a few things. One, the staff needed to constantly surveil patients so they could intervene if their behavior escalated. So what do we need? More staff. Mm-hmm. Some patients were given things called suicide tags. And these tags just looked like little metal tags, kind of like a dog tag. They were slightly narrower and longer than that, and they had a hole punched in one end. It says, Suffolk District Asylum, this patient is not to be left, number 41. Staff also needed to be trained in manual restraint.
Oh, no.
So if they were going to abolish the use of restraints that were not manual, but then they did need to manually restrain somebody for one reason or another, staff needed to know how to do that. And all of this costs money.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was done? Well, mostly isolation and sedation. Remember how I said that what is considered humane is certainly relative to the time period and even more relative to what came before it? Well, this is a perfect example of that. The therapeutic rationale of seclusion, this is a quote, was to remove the patient from the cause of his or her agitation and to limit external stimulation until they calmed down. My bone that I have to pick with this is that what if the problem is in your own mind?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if the cause of your agitation is in your brain?
So all you're doing is actually putting you in an arena with the thing that is agitating you.
Yes.
Yes. You're just trapped with the thing.
The padded cell was used statewide for isolation purposes. As for sedation, patients were given laudanum or strychnine to keep them calm or sedated. Laudanum was a combination of morphine, alcohol, and codeine. And strychnine was a highly poisonous substance that could kill, even in small doses. In fact, according to the CDC, today it is used in pesticides to kill rats.
That will certainly sedate someone.
It will. Very much so.
Yes.
With the sheer volume of patients in these state institutions, applying that moral treatment envisioned by the reformers was not really working. While the original intentions were to rehabilitate, they ultimately ended up relying still on things like restraints, seclusion, and sedatives. And by the end of the 1800s, this brighter landscape of treatment for those with mental illness was actually quite dim. So up until this point, we've spoken only about the Victorian Asylum in England and English asylum reform. But these models and ideas spread quickly to the United States in the 18 and 1900s. Nearly everything that applied to the Victorian asylum applied to the American one. So the first asylum to open in the United States was called the Friends Asylum.
That seems, I'm guessing, like a mislabel here.
The Friends. And it opened its doors in 1818 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And the construction and opening of this facility sparked a flurry of construction, namely on the East Coast. Massachusetts General Hospital built the McLean Hospital outside of Boston in 1811. And the New York Hospital built the Bloomingdale Insane Asylum in Morningside Heights in Upper Manhattan in 1816. So that, like, 1810 to 1820, all along the East Coast of the United States, there was just a boom in the asylum industry. Let's call it that.
Sure.
Yeah. And these U.S. facilities were operating using the same strategies as their English counterparts, like the moral treatment philosophy we spoke about, but also sedation, isolation, restraints in extreme circumstances. So now that we have all of that background, let's talk about Pennhurst.
Okay.
This is where we are going to get into the historical usage of some incredibly offensive language. Again, please know that we do not condone the use of it and are only referencing it in its historical contexts. Inspired by the Victorian asylums that we've been discussing thus far, came a new type of facility in the United States. And these facilities were meant to be different from the asylums, which were reserved, as we know, for so-called lunatics and mad people. Beginning around 1850, America began to address the problem of the feeble-minded with institutions called state schools, which were meant solely for the care and maintenance of epileptics and idiotic persons. That's a quote. In today's terms, this facility was meant to service those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, not mental illnesses.
Okay.
Yes. Some examples of intellectual and developmental disabilities today include ADHD, autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, various language and speech disorders, and Tourette syndrome, to name a few. Now, originally, these schools were meant to supplement what the traditional education system could not provide to students who had intellectual or developmental disabilities, but it eventually became more about isolating them from society, very similar to that custody versus cure mentality that we spoke about. A quote. Pennhurst was a product of the pseudoscience that asserted that people with intellectual disabilities needed to be shut away from the world for their own benefit and, more pointedly, for the benefit of the larger society. So I want to take a quick moment to address the concept of eugenics, which we've talked about here. I don't remember the context.
I don't either, but I know we have.
We have, because you said it and I said, what's that? And yes, that's how I remember. And then you defined it. From history.com, the best website. Eugenics is the practice or advocacy of improving the human species by selectively mating people with specific desirable hereditary traits. It aims to reduce human suffering by breeding out disease, disabilities, and so-called undesirable characteristics from the human population. And this was rampant in the 19th and 20th centuries because of the increase in intellectualism, which ironically was also partially responsible for the increase in understanding of mental illness and intellectual disabilities.
Which you would think would end up being like a positive cycle instead of a bad one.
Yes, exactly. But it, no. On May 15th, 1903, the idea for the Eastern Pennsylvania Institution for the Feeble-Minded and Epileptic was born. Again, we've lumped together disabilities of the intellectual variety with neurological conditions, despite how vastly different these things are in literally every single way from symptom to treatment.
Yes.
Completely different. This facility was to be state-funded, and it was originally intended to house 500 people who had been deemed the following: epileptic, idiotic, imbecile, feeble-minded. Another thing that I kind of like really hit me when I was doing this episode was every word that we use and have used as an insult has a very dark origin.
Mm-hmm.
Like the word idiot, right? We use it, you're an idiot, Steve. Like
yeah,
we use these words just completely, just, we don't even think twice.
Yeah.
But the origin of this word is very dark.
Yeah.
And we don't think about it. So this facility was to be split in half. The one part for the custodial and asylum department, and the other part for the educational and industrial department. So Pennhurst was going to have two halves to it. And if we remember back to Dr. William Ellis, the goal was for the facility to essentially be self-operational. Patients would work on the premises doing various things, like farming. For compensation? No.
So this is indentured servitude.
Yes, it was called peonage.
Oh.
P-E-O-N-A-G-E. Let me define peonage.
I was going to say, I never heard that word.
Is a system where an employer compels a worker to pay off a debt with work.
Okay.
So you're a peon. Yes.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was outlawed in 1867.
Good to know.
Now, Pennhurst was a campus, okay? It was a town unto itself. 7 years after it opened in 1910, 11 buildings had been constructed with the ultimate goal of constructing 23.
Wow.
I'm just going to list for you some of the facilities that Pennhurst boasted. A full dental clinic, a regular hospital, as well as a tuberculosis hospital, a pharmacy, an X-ray department, an entire department dedicated to sewing, mending, printing, and weaving, a school, a bakery, several kitchens, a butcher, and a vegetable preparation room, a reservoir, a power plant, and a sewage disposal plant, a farm, peach and cherry orchards, a poultry farm, and a cattle farm for both dairy and beef, a piggery.
A piggery.
A piggery. A beauty shop, a barber shop, a gymnasium, a shoe shop, and a tailor shop. This is not an exhaustive list, okay? There was more.
Wow.
Wild. By 1920, there was an entirely different set of buildings for what they called the female colony.
Out of context, that sounds like a great place to live.
You ever read the book Her Land? Probably not. It's about a utopian society that is all women.
Okay.
And men stumble upon it. Yeah. Mm. I read it in undergrad. Overall, by 1945, Pennhurst was 1,400 acres. That is 1,058 football fields.
Wow.
And this all sounds very costly, doesn't it?
It does.
It all fit very nicely with the goal. A quote: Pennhurst was designed to be a world apart.
A what?
A world apart. One that would function nearly independently and could be, if not forgotten entirely, ignored just as the people sent there were.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I'm glad. I'm not glad, but, you know, I'm glad you brought up eugenics, because this is very much, like, that's like the example you know, like, send all the people with this particular disease to, like, an island to die out, essentially.
Yes, that's what this was. Yeah. This was literally a world apart, put them over here in a self-sufficient town that they will run to prevent them from breeding mm-hmm. and contaminating normal society.
Yeah, I would not be surprised to find out that they were being, like, forced birth control, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. One of the primary reasons beyond just what we normally see is the reasons for separating males and females was to keep them from breeding.
Wow.
Yes. The first patient was admitted on November 23rd, 1908, and he was referred to as patient number one, as far as the records were concerned, a practice that continued for Pennhurst's over 10,000 patients. However, informally, the patients were not referred to as patients at all, but as inmates.
God, language is so important.
It really is. This is what people are like, it's just a word. It's really not.
It's not.
There's just, as far as I'm concerned, like, nothing more powerful than a word.
Mm-hmm.
From the jump, overcrowding and underfunding were essentially synonymous with the word Pennhurst. As I said, this was a massive facility, and it was essentially under construction for the first 25 years of its existence. Very little attention was paid to beautification or maintenance or updating. And disturbingly, every patient at Pennhurst was referred to as a child, despite the fact that many were literal adults.
Ew.
It was not the men's ward and the women's ward, but the boys' ward and the girls' ward. Oh, it was not the men's dining room and the women's dining room. It was the boys' dining room and the girls' dining room.
Wow. Again, words.
Words. And it's dehumanizing.
It is. And again, really drives home the fact that these people should not be engaging in sexual contact because they're children.
Yes. And also, the rights you're afforded as a child versus the rights you're afforded as an adult.
Yes.
Like that. Two.
I was actually just talking about this with my aunt on the cruise, how, like,
mm-hmm.
people still hit their children. But if you hit an adult, you go to jail. But you're just allowed mm-hmm. to do that to children.
Yep.
Wild.
Although children were admitted between the ages of 6 and 16, many were institutionalized at Pennhurst for over 40 years.
Wow.
A quote, denying people the recognition of their actual age and status as adults is an insidious form of dehumanization.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the educational and industrial department.
Okay.
This was the part of Pennhurst that was society-facing. Mm. So remember how we had the custodial and the asylum department? This is the educational and industrial department. So this is the other half.
Okay.
Hundreds of photographs were shared over the years of the industrial and educational department in brochures and public reports and informational books showcasing the department that was, you know, proper, I guess, yeah. for society to see. Of course, the images never really told the whole story. Employment of the patients was paramount to the facility's functioning. Patients worked the farms. They worked in the kitchen, in housekeeping, in maintenance, in the laundry. A lot of them even helped to care for other patients. There are photos of patients operating heavy machinery like harvesters.
Oh.
Between 1921 and 1922, the laundry processed nearly 1.7 million pieces of clothing, bedding, and other goods. This work in particular was done by 4 paid employees and 40 non-paid patients.
Wow.
All of this labor wasn't just to keep the facility functioning. It was for profit. Okay. From 1924 to 1926, Pennhurst reported a $50,587 profit, which today would be $650,000.
Wow.
And these patients are not being compensated.
My goodness.
The employment of these patients showcased a certain hypocrisy, which is oddly familiar lately. These patients were not ill, because if they were, they really would not have been working as hard as they were. And if they could be entrusted with these jobs, they weren't in need of confinement.
Right. Like you said, operating heavy machinery and stuff.
Yes. So if someone can work very hard, Why are they locked up in their house with no access to their cell phone or anything like that?
Which is also...
Or able to drive.
Oh, weird. Or, like, get coffee and it's...
Or, like, get coffee or have a credit card or spend any of the hard-earned money. Okay.
Yep. And it's, again, forced birth control. There it is.
It is. And, again, we make silliness of this, but I don't care what anybody says. Britney Spears was a human rights issue.
Yes, it was. It was.
Completely. Patients who failed to comply were faced with loss of privileges. I can't really imagine what privileges they were afforded, but they were faced with loss of them. In 1923, the facility's name was officially changed to Pennhurst State School. It was not until 1974 that children with intellectual disabilities were guaranteed to receive a free and public education. And it was this fact that led to Pennhurst's growing admission.
Oh.
Did you studying education, did you learn anything? You must have, right?
Yeah, like, I'm thinking of the act IDEA, but I think that that was later. But yeah, there's, like, the law, basically, that says that, like, they have to provide accommodations in the public school for students with disabilities. Or if the school can't provide it, then the government has to help the student be able to attend a school that can provide it.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Okay. Pennhurst boasted many classrooms where the patients were taught various skills that were mostly manual. Wood chopping, weaving, things of this nature that result in the production of something that can be sold.
Weird.
There are photos that show students in English class, an art class, and the female patients took home economics classes when they turned 14. And music actually played an important role at Pennhurst. There was a marching band, and patients were taught to play instruments or sing, both for each other and also off the property at local churches and schools.
Probably getting paid to do so, but not the patients themselves.
Not the people.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the custodial and asylum department. Oof. We've spoken a lot about the industrial and educational department, but there's the other one. The custodial and asylum department, this is deplorable stuff. Just a warning going into it. This was the part of Pennhurst that was not society facing. What was projected outwardly was not true to what was occurring on the inside. This department was virtually invisible to the public. In fact, photography was forbidden and staff were told this.
Oh, that's never good.
A quote, that invisibility, fueled by the belief that some people were helpless without hope of any meaningful life, allowed unfavorable conditions to grow and fester. Cleanliness and sanitation were a huge issue. To give you a sense of just how overcrowded and underfunded Pennhurst was, it was reported that the patients shared toothbrushes. Ugh. You pretty much just grabbed whichever toothbrush was hanging in front of the sink where you were standing.
Oh no.
As you can imagine, this contributed greatly to the spread of infectious disease. On this note, the TB hospital that I mentioned was built under the premise that the so-called feeble-minded were particularly prone to disease.
No.
No.
Don't think
so. I think you're just perpetuating the disease cycle by the conditions of the facility. Also, in case you forgot, this facility was opened with the intention of housing 500 people. Well, within 8 years of opening, it housed 900, and at its peak, held 4,100 individuals.
4,100? Oh, no.
Individuals.
That is very beyond capacity.
Yes. There are some images that do exist that show various things. A wall of toilets less than 2 feet apart with no barriers or walls between them. Beds crammed together with less than 1 foot between them. This is not only a sanitation issue, but this is a massive privacy issue. The underlying implication is that these patients at this facility were simply not entitled to something like privacy. Mm-hmm. Many of the patients in the custodial and asylum department were left idle, which led to behavioral changes, which led to restraint. Not to mention, it was often the patients in the educational and industrial department who were caring for the patients in the custodial and asylum department.
You ever heard of the Stanford Prison Experiment?
I think I have, yes.
Yeah, that's the one where they assigned some people to be the guards and some people to be the prisoners.
Yes.
And yeah.
It was like a power measure,
yep.
Right?
Bedlam.
Mm-hmm. Yes, to see how you would behave if you were given power and had it and stripped you of power. Yes, I've heard about that.
Yeah.
patients were not permitted to wear their own clothing, and state clothing was purchased from correctional institutions. If you wanted to wear your own clothes, you were responsible for the maintenance of them. Patients were at the mercy of what was clean and available, whether it fit them or not.
I'm guessing they didn't have access to do their own laundry.
I mean, that was in the educational and industrial department. In 1968, 50 years after Pennhurst opened and 20 years before its closure, a five-part expose called Suffer the Little Children was aired. A reporter at the time named Bill Baldini spent 4 days at Pennhurst with a film crew, and it featured some of the only footage of the facility. Now, you can watch this. I didn't watch the whole thing. I watched like a decent amount of it. It's not that long. So think of a news, you're watching the news, it's 10 p.m., you know, the nightly news is on, and a reporter runs a segment, right? It's like 3 to 5 minutes. This was like about 5 7-minute segments over the course of 5 nights. So cumulatively, about 35 to 40 minutes of content. This is some of the only footage from within the facility while it was active. No faces of the patients were revealed, but horrifically, patients were seen tied to their beds and in straitjackets. Not to mention, some of the beds were more like cribs or cages featuring 2 to 3 foot bars around them. These were like 6-year-olds in these cribs.
Like actual children.
Yes. And it was indiscernible because, like I said, there's no faces. You really only saw like feet and hands or like silhouette. But some of them looked like they could have been older than 6.
So do we know where the children admitted, or are these children the result of patients getting together?
Well, wait a second.
Oh, boy.
Adult patients are seen wandering aimlessly in empty rooms. Some are seen legitimately rocking back and forth.
Oh, my God.
There were, at a time, 1,000 infants on the premises, kept in cribs that were head-to-head and foot-to-foot. These children had no stimulation and little to no human contact.
Oh, God.
They were admitted between 6 months and 6 years. So they would still be infants at 6 months.
Right.
I don't think the patients were reproducing personally, but I don't know. I actually didn't see anything that said if they were or weren't.
How do you admit
but a 1,000 infants?
How do you determine that a 6-month-old needs to go to an asylum?
I mean, remember, it's for intellectual disabilities. So, like, you could know at that age if your child was going to suffer from
Down syndrome, an
intellectual disability. Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. Baldini, the reporter who did this expose, boldly called out society's neglect of the patients within Pennhurst walls, stating how they'd been abandoned and forgotten. And he actually called for immediate state intervention.
Good.
It's scary to know that the footage is real footage, and it's not just a horror movie.
My God. Yeah, sounds like if you do watch it, we suggest caution.
Yeah. Let's talk about the end, because I don't want to talk about it happening anymore.
Yeah.
Several things contributed to Pennhurst's downfall, as well as to the downfall of other similar facilities. Firstly, in 1966, an act was passed by the Pennsylvania legislature that authorized community programming for people with intellectual disabilities. Now, the name of this act does contain a word that is now considered a slur, so please be aware that we are only using it in its context. This act was called the Pennsylvania Mental Health and Mental Retardation Act of 1966. And this act also added more checks and balances when it came to how easy it was to end up institutionalized and in the system. In 1968, the expose we already spoke about was released, which revealed the reality of what was actually going on inside of Pennhurst. And the public was disgusted and outraged, especially those who had family members in the facility. As we mentioned earlier, in 1974, the Equal Educational Opportunities Act was passed, which made it possible for all children to receive a public education. And then a true turning point was when the mother of a Pennhurst resident brought a civil case against the facility. Also in 1974, Halderman versus Pennhurst was really the straw that broke this camel's back here. This was a class action lawsuit, which meant that multiple plaintiffs were able to prosecute.
Wow.
Yeah, and this lawsuit was brought on behalf of current and former residents of Pennhurst against the institution, its leadership, and any state officials responsible for the facility's operation. Here is a quote. The plaintiffs, represented by prominent civil rights attorney David Furlager, argued that the institutionalization of the residents violated their constitutional rights under the 1st, 8th, 9th, and 14th Amendments, as well as under federal civil rights law and the Pennsylvania Mental Health and Mental Retardation Act of 1966. Let's talk about amendments. So the First Amendment guarantees freedoms concerning religion, expression, assembly, and the right to petition. The Eighth Amendment prohibits the use of cruel and unusual punishment. The Ninth Amendment protects the right to vote, the right to travel, the right to privacy, and the right to your own body. I know it's a weird one.
Yeah.
The 14th Amendment provides all U.S. citizens equal protection under the law. After 32 days of trial in Pennsylvania, Judge Raymond J. Broderick found the following about Pennhurst. Pennhurst was overcrowded, understaffed, and lacked the programs needed for adequate habilitation. He found that various unwarranted forms of restraints were used as control measures in lieu of adequate staffing, including seclusion rooms, physical restraints, and psychotropic drugs. The physical environment was found to be hazardous to the residents both physically and psychologically, to the extent that it was not only not conducive to learning new skills, but it is so poor that it contributes to losing skills already learned.
Wow.
Residents were found to have been subject to abuse by both other residents and staff. He required Pennhurst to arrange for suitable living conditions and for the arrangement of legitimate community services to support the patients. By 1977, this case was tried, and Judge Broderick ruled that the institutionalization of those with intellectual disabilities was unconstitutional.
Wow. 1977.
So, yes, again, what is that, 50 years ago?
Yeah.
Throughout the late 70s, several other acts were passed that directly addressed the rights of those with mental and physical handicaps, such as the Federal Developmental Disabilities Assistance and Bill of Rights Act and the Federal Education for All Handicapped Children Act. I want to make special reference to the Mental Health Act of 1983, which says, when you can be detained in a hospital and treated against your wishes. You can be detained if professionals think your mental health puts you or others at risk and you need to be in a hospital. Staff may be able to give you treatment even if you don't want it. And when you are detained, you have the right to appeal and the right to get help from an independent advocate.
Okay.
In 1985, the settlement of Halderman versus Pennhurst. Okay, what year was that? That was actually brought up? 1974.
Yeah.
So that was what?
Like 11 years later.
11 years. The settlement of Halderman versus Pennhurst resulted in the closure of the facility, and between 1986 and 1987, Pennhurst was officially closed.
1986, huh?
Yeah. This was all part of a larger move toward deinstitutionalization, which is, according to the Britannica's, a movement that advocates the transfer of mentally disabled people from public or private institutions, such as psychiatric hospitals, back to their families or into community-based homes. And this was made possible by several factors in the 20th century, and it applied not just to intellectually disabled, but also to the mentally ill. Medication, obviously. The first antipsychotic drug was developed, I think, in like 1951. Mm-hmm. And also different types of therapy, psychoanalysis, just to name a few things that contributed to this deinstitutionalization movement. But ultimately, it all came down to a significant increase in the understanding of those with mental illness and intellectual disabilities. So let's talk, before we wrap up, about Pennhurst today. Well, it's considered a historical site, so you can actually visit the campus and go on tours, guided by historians during the day.
Okay.
And they actually have a photography tour where you can take as many photos as you like. They'll take you in and out of the buildings. I think I would do that. It would probably be really fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. Sounds very interesting.
Yeah. And like I feel like it's unusual for a place like that to allow you just free reign mm-hmm. to photograph.
Yeah.
Some of the tours are considered paranormal. If you go in the evening, you can even buy snacks and merchandise.
I don't know.
And participate in EMF and EVP sessions.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
I don't really know. I mean, the snacks and the merch.
It's a little weird.
It is a little weird. At the right time of year, it's a haunted attraction by the name of Pennhurst Asylum. This place was not an asylum. it was not.
No.
It was considered a school.
Yeah.
And a hospital. So I take issue with them making this into a haunted space.
Yeah. I don't like that.
No. It's also a museum. I take less issue with that.
It feels like they're still finding a way to exploit the patients.
Yes.
Yeah.
It definitely does. To make matters weirder, you can rent the site for your own paranormal investigation, which definitely seems worth a minimum $1,200.
It's actually not that bad.
It's not. You can bring up to 10 people. I believe you head in there at around 7 p.m. and you come on out at around 3 a.m.
What? They don't even let you stay till 3:15?
You know what? That is a great point.
3:15 is like when the demons come out. What do you mean?
The demons, that's like they're like, yeah, they clock in at to work at 3:15 and they work for 45 minutes and then they go other jobs.
You don't even get to stay. Wow. Because the demons only stay out between 3:15 and 3 and 4 a.m. because 4 a.m. is when all the bakeries open. So it's too pleasant outside. The demons have got to go.
It's not even about the pleasantry. It's about they need their fresh rolls.
Right.
It's,
they got to go to the bakery. So
their haunting concludes and they go to get their donuts.
I only thought about that because I saw a post once that was like supposed to be comforting. And it was like, if you wake up at 4 a.m. and you're afraid, like just think of the bakers clocking in.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that. You can also rent the site for film productions, photography, and music video productions.
Have there been any?
I don't know. You know what? Let's Google it
quick.
Yeah,
I'm kind of curious.
Okay, so BuzzFeed did an episode, The Horrors of Penhurst Asylum. It was never an asylum. It is colloquially known as Penhurst Asylum.
Yeah.
It was never an asylum. It doesn't look like there's been a lot.
That's good.
I mean, definitely like ghost hunters.
Sure.
Things of that nature.
Well, I'm kind of glad then that people have not really jumped on exploiting this site.
It says that in just a quick little search here, it says, what is that? Scary Stories You Tell in the Dark.
Yeah.
Was that a movie recently? It says 2019.
Yeah.
Guillermo del Toro.
Yes.
This says that, again, I can't read past the headline because I don't subscribe to this newspaper. It says Penhurst's controversial history exploited in Guillermo del Toro's latest movie.
Okay.
It says the setting is a mythical Mill Valley, Pennsylvania. Yeah, okay.
Well, Penhurst is probably kind of close to us here, so we could take a tour.
Yeah,
maybe.
I thought about it. I mean, it's really not far.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to end on one little note here before we wrap it up. I'm going to end it with a quote. People with disabilities, intellectual and otherwise, do not need to live in a false world apart. They need what we all need, acceptance, friends, love, and community.
Yeah.
The world apart really got me.
Yeah.
I thought that was... It's just specific choice of word to use.
Right.
So, yeah, when I said that I hoped that the Penhurst in Stranger Things was not actually based on this Penhurst, all of what I just said is why.
Yeah.
I just don't know how it could not be.
Yeah. Yeah, because they've been talking about Penhurst in season one.
Yeah.
It feels like now we finally see it, so there's got to be a reason. So.
Yeah.
I can imagine we're going to get more of it in season 5.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, 1983, 4, 5, 6, when the show is taking place, like this place would have been at the height of its controversy.
Right.
So it would be like historically relevant. But I didn't, based on like what we saw of the facility, I mean, even the way that Victor Creel is locked up in a cell,
I know.
Like this, it's like doubling as a prison.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Which feels like... something the real Penhurst probably did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was very interesting and a really sad history, but a really important one.
Yeah, I think we got to shed light on these things. So thank you for listening if you did. And you can watch that little expose if you're interested.
Yeah.
But just like we said, kind of fair warning if you're going to do that, it's on YouTube. You can find pictures of, you know, the society-facing side of things, but... finding pictures of the not society side is pretty difficult, which I think is why it was so groundbreaking that they let him in to do that expose.
Right. I know. It's like kind of shocking. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, next week we are back to our chapter episodes.
Yes.
Is it the Nina Project?
I believe it is. The start of my favorite arc.
let's talk about the Nina Project next week. So we're going to start that up. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for doing this really in-depth report for us.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, everybody. Well, till next week, stay strange.
Stay strange.
To keep in touch and stay informed, join us on our Starcourt Study Hall Discord server and follow us on Instagram at Starcourt Study Hall.